This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the November 6th edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, it's all about looking back. Vancouver filmmaker Anne-Marie Fleming's great-grandfather was a famous Chinese vaudevillian. Now she's produced a graphic novel about his legacy. We explore the magical life of Long Tack Sam. And Jonathan Holliff's father managed one big client, Mr. Johnny Cash. Now Jonathan is writing a book and making a documentary film about his dad and his relationship with the man in black. Plus the music of Guelph Ontario's The Bar Mitzvah Brothers live in our studio like a sibling Jew. This is Q. Well, the final curtain came down on vaudeville long ago. And without film or audio recordings to document them, many vaudeville performers have been forgotten. But Anne-Marie Fleming, a Vancouver animator and experimental filmmaker, has taken up the challenge. She researched the life of a Chinese magician and vaudevillian known as Long Tack Sam. He was a headlining vaudeville act in the early 1900s, a colleague of Houdini, a mentor to Orson Welles, and Anne-Marie's great-grandfather. She's now taken her 2003 award-winning documentary film, The Magical Life of Long Tack Sam, and turned it into a vivid and entertaining graphic novel. Anne-Marie Fleming joins us live now from our Vancouver studios. Hello.
Hi, Jian.
How are you?
I'm very good.
You know, the most amazing thing about this book, one of them, is that you had this very, very famous great-grandfather. But before you started researching his life, you didn't even know that you had a famous great-grandfather. Is that true? Why was that?
Well, basically, I mean, I knew he was a magician, but I'd only heard a couple of things about him. And I guess what the film and the book explores is why is that? Why was he forgotten? And, you know, I can only postulate maybe it was a show business thing. A lot of people don't really have great memories of their ancestors or slash parents who were always on the road, always on tour. Is it because he was an immigrant and he moved on to a different land and a different time in his life? Were there things he wanted to forget? Is it because there wasn't anything filmic? There's nothing archival in that way? Is it because he was Chinese? There's all these questions, and I don't really answer them.
Well, I want to ask you who he was in a moment. But first, I know you're making the case why people in the broader world don't necessarily remember Long Tack Sam. But why in your family was he not talked about until you did this?
Well, the family is pretty fractured, and we live all over the world, and we're not so much in touch. And like I said, he was in show business, and I think that a lot of us, we look at our relatives and we see them for who they are to us, as mothers or brothers or sisters or fathers, or what are they giving us? We're all very me-centric, and we don't see how they fit into the larger context of the world. We don't care.
Who was Long Tack Sam?
Long Tack Sam was...
Can you do this briefly?
Well, he was an amazing individual. He was born in a small town in China, and he landed up being a headliner all over the world on the vaudeville circuit. He did this sort of full-on Chinese acrobatic, magic, comic, musical routine. He traveled the world with up to 80 performers. He married an Austrian woman in 1908, which was incredible. They had two biracial children who they put in their act and
incredible because it was unheard of.
So you think about the cultural leaps that was then. This traveling guy with a queue who did a, you know, he did his famous act at that point in his life was sliding down from the ceiling on his hair. So quite a catch.
Okay. What was it about his act that made him so successful as a vaudevillian to audiences around the world?
You know, there were a lot of Chinese acts that went around at that time, but they all went back to China. And I think that Long Tak San was able to adapt to a more Western sensibility, that he was really an incredible businessman, entrepreneur, and showman. And I think that he was able to capture something that some of the other groups were not able to do. And he was very famous for his goldfish bowl trick.
What was the goldfish bowl trick?
He does a somersault on stage and then does some sort of nothing up my sleeve and comes up with a 20-pound bowl full of water and goldfish, which is, I understand, quite difficult.
I want to see him now, you see?
Well, I saw this particular trick done in China, actually, a few years ago, and I hate to say it, it was kind of boring. And even though you knew how difficult and impossible it was still boring. And I think that's what made the difference with him, is that he made it exciting.
You know, you chronicle in this graphic novel the journey that you had to take. I mean, you've been all around the world just to find out more about him. Uh-huh. And you talk about the period of vaudeville in which your great-grandfather performed as almost being completely faded from living memory. How challenging was it for you to piece together biographical information about him?
It was really difficult. My family didn't know much about him, people who are left now. And I started this research in earnest about 10 years ago, and I felt like I was 10 years too late, that a lot of people had already passed on. But I thought, you've got to start sometime. So I traveled everywhere. Any time I heard there was someone living who had seen his act or knew him or had a story, I just went.
How do you separate the conjecture from empirical evidence?
Well, you can't. I mean, another theme of the book is, what is history and who said it last, and how did they get that information from? And what is memory even? There's so many different stories to Long Tak Sam, and I figured out at some point that he was probably the author of most of them, and he turned his story as it pleased him at different times in his life. So it could all be conjecture, but there's still a lot of truth in it.
You know, one of the themes of the book, for me, it seems, is the complexity of ethnic identity and how that identity necessarily needs to change as the world changes and through historical events.
Exactly.
Which is really quite remarkable. I mean, he was a big star.
Yes.
And yet, you know, when he's starting out, people don't even know that necessarily he's Chinese. They think he's doing some sort of shtick, and he plays up to that. And then later, he's considered not Chinese enough. And at times, it's good that he has an Austrian wife. At times, they have to downplay that, like when they go to China, and then Nazism comes and changes everything. Tell me a bit about discovering that complexity of identity and what it meant for your great-grandparents.
Well, it's interesting because I don't see how the world has changed that much. You know, it's good to be one culture one year and bad the next year. And in that time, of course, having cultures mix up like that was extremely uncommon. I mean, I guess that's sort of the central issue. How was he able to cross all of those boundaries? His girls, who were half Asian, half Austrian, were just gorgeous. And I think that he and his wife, too, I know this is sort of a weird theory, but I think the reason they were able to cross so many boundaries in some ways was because they were all so crazily good looking, you know? And it's true, breaks get given to the beautiful. And also, it was a time where not a lot of people moved, but entertainers moved all around the world, and people were always mixing it up with presenting different sorts of cultures, and the whole history of magic, borrowing from Orientalism, and all of these beautiful colors and mysteries and enigmatic props from the East that you could just come into Bohunk anywhere city in the middle of North America in the middle of the winter and put on this fabulous show. And I think people were just awed. It was such a beautiful and exciting break from their everyday lives.
But is there an underpinning at times of of conflict, of sadness, that some of this success at times came at the hands of denial of their own identity.
Well, yes, generally, but I think in Long Tak Sam's case, he completely exploited his Asian-ness and his exoticism. Obviously, as you were alluding to, it worked better than others at other times as he was building his career. But I think that he always celebrated his Chinese-ness, and there were two types of audiences that went to him. Of course, the Western audiences, and there was a very enthusiastic Chinese fan base as he traveled around the world, too, and the whole Chinese diaspora, who went to see him for very different reasons indeed.
Do you, with the, you've had quite a diverse background as well, and lived in many places. You've settled in Vancouver. How did discovering Long Tak Sam's story give you a sense of who you are?
Well, this is the strange thing. I mean, like I said, my family was not so much in contact. And as I spent years keeping on going back to them with little bits of information that I was getting from other people around the world, and then finally showed them the film and now the book, that they could suddenly see that there was this great pattern in our family and that we all fit quite well and interestingly into it. And, you know, even in my case, when I made the film, because there was no footage that I could find of Long Tak Sam, although I heard that some did exist, I landed up creating these strategies with illustrations and with the photographs that I was able to find and animating them all. And of course, what could be the most direct legacy between my great-grandfather and myself is animation. The first films were created by, you know, photographers and magicians, like the work of Georges Méliès and things like this. So there it was, you know, chip off the old block, so to speak.
I'm detecting that when you first started out doing this, the journey to learn about Long Tak Sam and do the biography, that your family didn't necessarily react super enthusiastically. Are they happy with the product now? Do they read the book and appreciate what you've done?
Well, you know, they love it. I got to say, they were confused and disinterested at the beginning of this project, but now they're the book's biggest fans. So it's pretty exciting. It really has brought the family closer together and made people quite proud of their history, which I think is part of the project of the book, certainly. I didn't know that's what I was doing specifically when I made the film.
It's a fascinating story, and I have to say it's extremely entertaining as well. It was one of those books where I about halfway through, I knew that I couldn't stop until I got through it. It's just a really, really fun read, and with the animation. So thank you for this, and thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Anne-Marie Fleming spoke to us from Vancouver. She will be in Toronto tomorrow night at the Gladstone Hotel for the launch of the Real Asian Film Festival. Her graphic novel, The Magical Life of Long Tak Sam, is published by Penguin and is available now.
This is Q, the podcast, with Gian Gameshi from CBC Radio 1.
He was and remains the man in black. His powerful songs won the hearts of country music fans, rockers, and prisoners alike. I am, of course, talking about the legendary Johnny Cash. But many, including Cash himself, would argue that his success was due to the Canadian behind the curtains. Saul Holliffe from London, Ontario, managed Johnny Cash from 1960 to 1973. That era saw Folsom Prison, San Quentin, A Boy Named Sue, and then addiction, divorce, remarriage, arrests, and trials. But just as Johnny's career peaked, Saul Holliffe quit. The reason for this has remained a mystery. And when Saul took his life 2 years ago, he took the answer with him. Saul Holliffe's son, Jonathan, discovered a secret storage locker belonging to his father, containing old articles, playbills, and hours of an audio diary. Now Jonathan is using this material as the basis for a feature-length documentary and a book titled My Father and the Man in Black. And we've reached Jonathan in studio in Los Angeles. Welcome to Q.
Thank you, John.
Good to talk to you, Jonathan.
Likewise.
How did your father, a Jewish guy from London, Ontario, hook up with a hard-living singer from the Bible Belt?
That's a good question. Saul started out as a rock and roll promoter in London, Ontario, back in the late 50s. In 1957, he brought Bill Haley and the Comets to London, and he followed that up with the Everly Brothers. He put a 16-year-old Paul Anka on the bill with Jimmy Rogers, also in 57, and many others, including Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry, Marty Robbins, the list goes on and on, until one day in 1958 he decided to book a band called Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two.
Their
first meeting was not a good one. According to Saul's diaries, Johnny glowered all evening, and they didn't hit it off at all. But regardless, Saul brought him back a couple of more times. And then finally, in May of 1961, booked Johnny on a 10-date tour of Ontario. And it was during that tour that they became friends, and Johnny asked Saul to manage him.
And is it true that Johnny wrote, said, sign this to on a piece of paper and said, now we have a contract, now you're my manager?
No, not at all. In fact, quite the opposite. They never had a written contract in the many years they knew each other. It was... they drafted notes. Johnny came off a plane in Newfoundland for another tour with some basic notes on a page, but they never actually executed a contract, which, of course, is unheard of today. But back in those days, a handshake was all it took.
Right.
But as you mentioned, Johnny picked up on Saul. He liked what he heard. He was quoted in his biography, as a matter of fact, his autobiography, as saying, "It was a new manager, Saul Holliffe, who pushed me to take my show and my career to another level. I was perfectly happy where I was, doing what I loved to do and getting paid for it. But after I got to know Saul, I started liking his ideas. Instead of just playing ballrooms and dance halls around the United States and Canada, he said I should be aiming at Europe, the Orient, and big places in big cities. Mm. Carnegie Hall, perhaps, the Hollywood Bowl. And that could be just the beginning. And what he said, he did."
So your dad, Saul, he becomes Johnny Cash's manager all through the 1960s, up until 1973. What kind of a relationship did these two men have?
Well, in a word, volatile. As you pointed out in your intro, these were the interesting years, the important years, the years that everybody talks about and people want to know more about. It was a period where Johnny was addicted to drugs in a very serious way and getting arrested all the time. In fact, within 1 week of Saul joining Johnny as his manager, Johnny was arrested for the first time in Nashville in November 1961 on a drunken disorderly charge and put in the drunk tank for a night. And just 1 week later, while playing 10 dates at the Cave in Vancouver, Johnny trashed the Hotel Georgia while trying to break down the door of the room of a love interest of his, who was Billie Jean, the widow of Johnny Horton, one of Johnny's best friends, who had died a few months before that. So,
how would Saul deal with this, with these kind of incidents?
Well, that evolved over the years, as you can imagine. That was the first time, to my knowledge, it was definitely the first time during their relationship that they were kicked out of the hotel and told never to return. And that happened over and over and over again over the years. Saul would, in the beginning, go to great lengths to try to protect his client. Later on, when June came along in 61, who, by the way, my father hired and matched with Johnny in, for the Big D Jamboree in Dallas in 61.
And the rest is history between those two, yeah.
Yeah, and by the way, it completely contradicts what we see in Walk the Line, but we can talk about that in a minute. In any event, Saul started by writing letters and trying to get a hold of the governor's office. And,
sorry, why don't you tell me now, what part of the June Carter Cash part contradicts what we see and Walk the Line?
Well, first let me say that I loved the movie. It was a great love story. Many people who outside the industry tend to forget that what they see in a Hollywood movie is not necessarily a fact or factual. For example, in the early part of the movie, we see June driving around in an old black Chevy with Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Elvis Presley going from gig to gig to gig in the late 50s. That never happened. That was all invented backstory to lend weight to this love story that the writer-producers were telling in that movie. The truth is, June and Johnny never spoke to each other for more than 1 minute before Saul hired June in December of 61 and put them together.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm curious about what you knew. I mean, you were a little kid, obviously, while Saul was managing Johnny Cash. What do you remember about those years? Do you have much recollection of that? Because this is part of this story is about you rediscovering your father's relationship with Johnny Cash, and I want to get to that. But first of all, tell me when you were a small kid. What do you remember about Johnny Cash and your dad?
Sure. I can tell you that my feelings for Johnny changed over the years. When I was very young, my father was always away, and every time I asked for him, my mother or our nanny would say, "He's with Johnny Cash." So when I was that small, I couldn't distinguish between my father and Johnny Cash, and I believed at the time that my father was Johnny Cash. Later, when my father took form as I grew a little older, I began to, I think, probably resent Johnny a little bit because I blamed him for taking my father away for such long periods of time. And then a few years later, when I was watching cartoons and, you know, the Justice League and Superman and all that stuff, I started to fall in love with Johnny Cash because to me he was a living, breathing superhero, you know, 6'4" and deep baritone voice. And he was always very generous and kind, and he would give us candy, and I looked at him like a superhero.
Jonathan, your dad quits managing Johnny Cash in 1973, and really since then, you became quite estranged from your father. And even when he died a couple of years ago, you didn't really have that much to do with him. And then one day, you discover your father's storage locker. Tell me about this incident and how things changed for you.
Sure. I'll try to make a long story short. We were estranged. I left home when I was 17 or 18. When my father quit Johnny in 73, I was nearly turning 10, and Saul's reaction was to put all of his Johnny Cash memorabilia away. And so it disappeared from our lives, and his name was really rarely, if ever, mentioned in our household. And because my father retired and never worked another day, he went back to university. He had to quit school in grade 9 to support his family in the middle of the Depression. And consequently, he was home all the time, and that's when things got worse for me because I was the eldest. And he kind of managed me like he managed Johnny Cash, which became apparent to me when I started exploring his archives. But we were estranged. The last time I saw him would have been about 7 years ago. And because my father was a born accountant, a guy who was a list maker who would always draw pros and cons, it didn't surprise me when he brought out his ledger and told me when I last saw him that we had only seen each other 17 days in 20 years. So when Saul took his own life in March of 2005, and didn't leave me a note, didn't say goodbye, not an article of clothing, not even a tie, I had an emotional crisis. I had always had father issues, but I had gone down that path of self-denial. I'd always avoided even thinking about it. And when he disappeared like he did, I awoke one day and realized that I had absolutely no passion for the entertainment business, and I finally fully realized that I only went into show business in an adolescent kind of knee-jerk reaction to try and gain Saul's respect, if not love, and I never got it while he was alive, and I sure as hell wasn't going to get it now that he was dead. So I packed it in and went back to Canada.
And then you find this treasure trove, though, of stuff. So very briefly, how did you find that?
Sure. I went to Canada to escape my father's shadow. I equated show business with emotional disturbance. I was going to turn over a new leaf, start a new chapter, and 3 months later, Walk the Line opens. And the next day, an article is published in the London Free Press called Saul Holliffe Deserves Role in Biopic. And then our phone starts ringing off the hook, and it doesn't stop. The media wants to know what we think of the movie. Biographers are calling, wanting to know if anything's left of Saul's files from his days with Johnny. I had been home now for 4 months, and I said to these people, listen, we're in mourning, and there's nothing here, you know, please respect our privacy. But they were persistent. They called back, and a month later, this one particular fellow had me on the phone asking me again if anything survived those years, and I said no, and all of a sudden, my mother tapped me on the shoulder and said, that's not quite true, son. And she pulled open the center drawer of my father's desk, and inside was a key. And the key led to a storage locker, and as it turns out, Saul had kept everything, not just from his time with Johnny, but about his whole life. In all, there were over 26 cartons of material, and it was just flabbergasting.
And including that material, these audio diaries that your father he taped telephone conversations with Johnny Cash. Why did he do that?
Well, first of all, that was the biggest surprise. I didn't set out to write a documentary or a book. I came to this reluctantly as a hostile witness, and I realized that I couldn't move past my father, and that this represented an opportunity for me to sort of wade into my father's life and explore him and try to understand him and hopefully make peace with him. But when I discovered those diaries, the audio, more than 60 hours, it became apparent that it could become a documentary.
Why did he make those tapes?
Well, he made them for several reasons. One, he was an archetypical, you know, man from the 50s. He didn't believe in psychiatrists or shrinks. He would never see one. So I believe that first and foremost, it was a form of self-analysis. He also, I think, was a narcissist, and narcissists love to indulge themselves in talking about their experiences and recording them for posterity. As for the telephone calls, that's a slightly more complicated issue, but I can say that it was never to have the goods on Johnny Cash. It was never to write a tell-all book. Saul was retired and not working for 40 years. He had plenty of time to do those things, but he never did. It wasn't his style. He was a man of integrity. The reason he did it was because I found in exploring these materials, starting in the early 1960s, because Johnny was so addicted to pills, he had a split personality. There was the good Johnny and there was the bad Johnny. And the bad Johnny didn't have a very good memory. And consequently, Saul would set up dates and fees and locations. And then the next day, Johnny would say, I didn't agree to that. So Saul started a practice, as evidenced in these letters that I found, of having witnesses to their conversations so that he could later say, John, listen, you did agree to this, and we are doing this. And when technology allowed, when it became possible to tape phone calls, that was just an extension of that. Okay, it was never about...
Jonathan, you've been kind enough to lend us one of these. I don't even know if this has ever been heard before, one of these telephone conversations, the audio of it. I want to play a bit of it here. We've got one of those conversations. This is between Saul Holliff and Johnny Cash, recorded in 1972. Here they're talking about The Gospel Road, the movie about the life of Jesus that Johnny starred in. The first voice you'll hear here is Johnny Cash.
Now, there's a couple of things I want to say to you that I need to clear the air completely with you all.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I knew way before I even did the film that there's a lot of people, maybe the majority of the people, are not going to buy what I'm saying in this film or what the film is saying. So you see, I don't really have to be told that because I know that.
I haven't. You say you don't have to be told that, but who said that?
You did. You said, in the dressing room at Saratoga, you said you realize, of course, that a lot of people are not going to agree with your film.
Well, when I make a statement like that, that's what is known as trying to be honest. Because, first of all, if you take 100 people, 25 of them are Christian faith and 20 of them are Muslims. And
yeah.
10, you know, that's what I meant.
Yeah, but I knew that originally, see.
Yeah.
Well, I just felt like that you didn't have a lot of interest in this film. And I just wanted to know if you don't, then I'll go ahead and do what I can do without you.
I'm one of the few people that try to say to you exactly what they think without meaning to be harmful. I'm not trying to break things down. I'm just trying to maybe temper things a little bit by saying not exactly what people think you want to hear.
Yeah, right.
I find a lot of people tell you exactly what you want to hear.
Yeah, I know that. I don't need that either.
And that doesn't help.
No, it doesn't.
Well, that's Saul Holliff talking to his client, Johnny Cash, there. And Saul Holliff, who managed Johnny Cash from 1960 to 1973. I'm speaking to Jonathan Holliff, his son, who's making who's writing a book and making a documentary film about the life of his dad managing Johnny Cash. Jonathan, I've got so much to ask you. There's so much here. I appreciate you coming up. Before I let you go, now that you, in the course of making this documentary and writing this book, and now that you're getting this insight into your dad's life and Johnny Cash, what do you think about Saul now?
I think I've made peace with him. I have to tell you, listening to my father's voice when he was my age, I'm 42 now, and these diaries started around the time he was my age, was a very spooky and emotional experience. But he detailed and chronicled his own battles with addiction, his alcoholism, his gambling in the stock market. He lamented his long absences from home. He would talk about coming home and not even the dog would recognize him. So I found empathy for my father. And given what he went through with Johnny Cash in the 1960s, I think most people would forgive him his own foibles. It was quite a story.
Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Much appreciated. Jonathan Holliff is the son of Saul Holliff, the man who managed Johnny Cash through his rise to fame. Jonathan's documentary and book, both titled My Father and the Man in Black, are due out in 2009.
This is Q, the podcast. You can catch Q, the program, weekdays on CBC Radio and several times a day on Sirius 137.
You know, sometimes it can get lonely in the studio, sitting here, talking into a microphone, just seeing Matt and Alain across the glass, feeling underappreciated. Oh, who am I kidding? I love this job. It's exactly what I want to do, talking to interesting people with great stories every day. And I am aware of how lucky I am. A lot of people despise their jobs. If you are one of those unfulfilled toilers, there's a new album you might appreciate. It's called Let's Express Our Motives, an album of underappreciated job songs, and it's by Guelph Ontario's The Bar Mitzvah Brothers, the group of four. Join me now in Studio Q, Jenny Mitchell, Jordy Gordon, Johnny Merritt, and sitting in for Tristan O'Malley today is Justin Nace from the London-based band called 2 Minute Miracles. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
There's a big build-up, and then you're like all quiet. Oh, okay. Oh, how you doing? No, you don't have to kick in.
You weren't making that up.
No, I was saying, hey, welcome.
Oh, hi.
Thank you. It's just so relaxed here.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's get them some Red Bull. Okay, let me get this out of the way. I'm not going to ask you where the name Bar Mitzvah Brothers comes from, because as somebody who played in a band called Moxie Fruvis for many years, I know what it's like to get that first question. I know that you're not brothers, because I'm looking at you, Jenny, but have you ever been to a Bar Mitzvah?
No.
Never. None of you.
I'm sorry.
So you are neither brothers nor you've been to a bar mitzvah. Well, that's very fine. Let me hear one of these songs. Let the people hear. I've heard the CD. It's quite a fine disc of job-related songs. I want to ask you in a moment why you decided to make this theme disc. But first of all, you're going to play something for us live in studio. What are you going to play for us?
We're going to play a song called Thrift Store Owner.
Thrift Store Owner, which has a relationship to your father, Jenny. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah, and it's also, Jordy and I work at a thrift store, my dad's thrift store.
You've always worked at a thrift store.
That's right. Yeah, 12 years now.
Can you name it? Can you name the thrift
store? The Family Thrift Store.
It's called the Family Thrift
Store? It's called the Family
Thrift
Store.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right, well, here it is. Thrift Store Owner on Q, the Bar Mitzvah Brothers, live in Studio Q.
At the store, there's a shrine. I can take my trips. Smashing mugs and ripping bathing suits. I even like it when he's really rude to people who deserve it. at the store. There's a shrine for employees, sometimes five, right downtown. A brave man to do this without a plan. There's so many things to find. Underneath all the underwear, there's a French horn in there that I think I'd like to try. This is where it all begins. At the store, there's a shrine for employees.
Live in Studio Q, that's Guelph, Ontario's The Bar Mitzvah Brothers and the song Thrift Store Owner from the new disc entitled Let's Express Our Motives. It's available now, and it's a 19-song theme record about work, including working in a thrift store, I
That's
guess.
That's right. Yeah.
Very nicely done, you guys. Johnny, you want to come over here to the microphone? You're spread out around the studio. We've got some acoustic drums happening here. We've got bass. We've got a piano and a keyboard. And then, Jenny, that's a banjo, but it's plugged in.
It's an electric banjo.
It's an electric banjo.
Right. It's like an electric guitar, but a banjo.
Do you ever, can you distort it?
If I put it through a distortion pedal.
Thank you, Jenny. Yeah. So, all right. Tell me about, tell people about this concept, because it's quite interesting. You go from song to song. These are songs about work. You're relating to the working people out there. Where did you come up with this idea for this record?
I think it started, we wrote a song for our friend Stuart, who was moving away. He was kind of Guelph's best promoter. At least in my opinion, I really loved every band he picked. I really loved, and he booked great shows for us, and he was moving away. So we played a going away party, and, it was his final show, actually, and so the show promoter song was about him. And then at the same time, I was reading a book called Working by Studs Terkel, and it's like this book from the 1970s that interviews hundreds of people about their various jobs, like being a call girl or working as an executive in like a high-rise or being a paper delivery boy or factory worker. And so I got the idea that they're really well-written stories and interviews, these ones, and I really like stories coming from random people, so I thought it would make an interesting challenge to see if I could capture them.
So this is interesting. I mean, very few artists do this these days. You actually came up with a concept for what you wanted the record to be,
yeah,
and then wrote the songs for it, to it,
yep,
right?
We wrote all the music in the studio, too, also on the fly.
So, Jordy, how did you decide what occupations you want to write songs about?
Well, Jenny had the book. She had the big idea, but I love any excuse. I'm always writing, whenever we have a Christmas show, I'll write Christmas songs, even though I'm a Scrooge, because I just love having an excuse to write about something. Not that there's things going on every day that you can write about, but just having to sit down, you know, we wrote a lot of songs very quickly. My songs kind of were just, they were kind of more made up, and I had stories in general, and I just fitted them into jobs. Like, I have a song about a projectionist, but it's more about just, someone watching, kind of watching life going on in the theater and on the screen.
You've got, I mean, there's a lot of occupations here. We've got the recording engineer, the rodeo clown, the janitor. Johnny, You guys haven't really, you haven't actually held these positions. You haven't actually had these jobs, right?
No, well, The thing is, I think there was some talk of me writing a song about being a meat clerk at a grocery store because that's actually my job.
You still a meat clerk?
Yeah, I still
that's
am.
That's great.
Yeah, no, I haven't
In between Bar Mitzvah Brothers tours?
Yeah, yeah, I haven't quit my day job.
What is a meat clerk?
I guess...
And why in God's name didn't you write a song about being a meat clerk?
I don't know. Laziness, I guess. I think I had to work, I guess.
Do you cut the meat?
Occasionally. I'm not supposed to, but sometimes I have to. Sometimes there are people who like need that pea meal bacon or whatever it is. You know?
Why are you not supposed to?
I don't know. It's like,
you're not
it's
qualified.
At theirs. It's a pretty regulated job. You know, it's like it's a corporation, so they have their rules.
Okay, so the jobs that you didn't haven't held, how did you know what you were doing, dealing with in terms of writing about uncharted territory, the things you haven't actually experienced, Jenny?
For me, it was a lot to do with the fact that there was a person behind each one. Like, it was sort of almost the opposite of Geordie's approach. Geordie kind of created people and placed them in these scenarios that he imagined and that he'd read about. And then mine were between the book and between people I know, actually, I actually knew somebody who'd done it and heard it kind of from their own mouth. So, I was secretly interviewing people without them knowing. I would ask friends of mine if, like, you know, what they did. And then when it happened to be interesting, I would sort of take notes without them knowing and then sneak it in there. But
now, Justin, you're filling in here today, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You're a London, Ontario compadre, and you guys are actually touring together, your band and the Bar Mitzvah Brothers.
Yeah.
What do you make of this whole... Did you have to learn all the work songs to be able to come in today? Or?
We had a quick rehearsal. We had a quick rehearsal last night, and we went over as many as we could, and I'm here today. It's a bit of a whirlwind. It's all right. We'll see.
Good.
Got a whole tour. By the time we get back to Thunder Bay, it'll be awesome.
Did you have a hand in picking which work songs you wanted to play bass on?
No. I think they've got their parts, and I got to learn them.
It's very gracious.
It's really because Tristan, the normal guy, couldn't get the day off work. So
is he also a meat clerk?
He works in insurance.
Yeah.
Info actuarial support or something like that.
Jenny, they say you write what you know, but you seem to have this journalistic approach to music making with the element of a story being at the core of your music. Why the fascination with other people's lives?
I think because mine has been so completely not underappreciated. It was funny, somebody asked me about whether or not one of the songs is about me, and I realized that I've never had a normal job. Like, people often say the worst job I ever had was this, or the most exciting, or the most boring, and in 12 years, I've had one job, and it's working for my father, and it involves, you know, like... We get to kick people out if we don't like them, you know. I get to put things up in funny places if I feel so inclined, you know. And
You have this job too.
Well, it's true, but this job's kind of a dream as well, you know. I've never had to do anything I didn't like.
So working in the thrift store is a dream.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I can take time off to go on trips, which is in that song. And then I do, and I live in two different cities, so that happens a lot. And
Should sub in for Johnny and be a meat clerk and learn something else, and then you'd have a reference point.
It's possible.
Yeah, that would be my dream.
That's Johnny's dream. Johnny, you could work at the thrift store.
Yeah, hey, that would be good.
I'm trying to facilitate things for you. I'm working on it. I'm negotiating.
Yeah, this could be a life-changing experience right here.
Or the band takes off and you all have to quit your day jobs, and you seem to be doing quite well. Okay, Jenny, you're also working on a book.
Yes.
What is this, the book you're reading?
It's a Cross Canada haircutting book.
A Cross Canada haircutting book.
Yes.
I'm on your standing at attention. Tell me more.
The basic idea is that I ask for volunteers, usually at shows, just because that's when I have access to a microphone and a lot of people. And I ask for volunteers who need haircuts, and I take a before and after photo, and I get them to tell me a story about themselves, which I record and then later transcribe. And then I'm also writing a journal in every city, so eventually there will be one long story about my various travels across Canada mixed with all these random strangers and their little personal lives, snippets and pictures of them.
I sense a haircutting across Canada album in the future. I don't know. This is just me.
It's a little overwhelming is the thing. At first I thought, it'd be so great to sum these people up in 2 minutes. And then it's more like 20 or half an hour, and they're the best storytellers ever, and I'm completely overwhelmed.
All right, speaking of storytellers, you guys are the storytellers in Studio Q right now. What, you're going to play another song live from your record. What song are you going to play?
We're going to play Piano Tuner.
Is there a story behind this?
This one's neat. It's half about a person we actually know. Andy, who recorded our album, was a piano tuner for a few years. It's also half about a man in the book working, who was a piano tuner, I think, for 15 or 16 years up until that point, at least. And so it's and Jordy wrote all the piano parts, and I wrote all the words, and then we mashed them together, you know, adding one more bar of piano here. So it's the most sort of mixed, like the most 50-50 Jordy and I, and the most 50-50 real-life person we know in the book. So
there you go.
Yeah.
The Bar Mitzvah Brothers, live in Studio Q, playing the piano tuner from their new record, Let's Express Our Motives.
He's there on a bicycle, and there on his feet. You can see his white belt out there in the street. He claims it's not a business, but a dedication. 15 years and gratification. It's just not his style. He just likes his job too much, 'cause it can't be taught. No, it can't be taught. Practice, not training. Just you go and ask him. He loves to tell you, and he'll start explaining. There's fewer young men in tuning. You don't make your money right away. Most are musicians. Uprights, it doesn't seem to attract young men, but eventually it might. Basic A440, then an octave down, then a relationship of that combination of tunes that make a good sound. Up a fifth, down a fourth, a circle, a fifth, and an octave. When you get it, balance the fourths and fifths. You take thirds and sixths, then you've got it. Make sure it's balanced, the rest of the octaves from up high down to down low. All you need is to count the beats and you can tune a piano. In the role his mother had once described. So he read as many books as he could gather and worked for free where he could try it.
Live in Studio Q, that's the Bar Mitzvah Brothers playing the song Piano Tuner, and that's Jenny on trumpet in that case rather than electronic banjo. Nicely done. Now, I'm just looking at the liner notes for your record, and I noticed that you understand that people are busy, so you've got 20, and you've got 20 songs to go through on the record, so you've actually organized playlists for people based on different musical styles. There's a danceable / pop hits. If you want to hear those songs, you listen to 1, 6, 4, 10, and 13. There's classic rock. There's just sentimental tracks. And then there's just ukulele.
Yes, there's a lot of ukulele songs.
And what do you want to listen to when you go home?
Me?
Which playlist?
I like to listen to it from start to finish, which actually, if you read the playlist list, it says at the beginning, you know, we'd, of course, love it.
You prefer that.
Yeah. I'm more of a listen to the first half, listen to the second half later, or listen to it on a random mix with many other albums on my iPod.
Thanks for coming in, you guys.
Oh, no problem.
Good luck with the tour and the work with the meat.
Thanks.
And the thrift store?
If people need haircuts at West, they should email us. I wanted to mention that.
Do they go to your website?
Yeah, all I right. have it all on the website.
The barmitzvahbrothers.com, if you're looking for and they're quite cheap, the haircuts, right?
They're free for the books. So.
That cheap. Okay. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the disc. The Bar Mitzvah Brothers are Jenny Mitchell, Jordy Gordon, Johnny Merritt, and sitting in for Tristan O'Malley today was Justin Nace. Tomorrow they set off on a Western tour, Western parts of the country. They'll be hitting up the Sault Ste. Marie, Winnipeg, Regina, Edmonton, and Vancouver, and more. Again, you can look for the complete schedule as well as a place to find a haircut at thebarmitzvahbrothers.com. You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.